For those of you who read your program, you may wonder what happened to my English accent. But in fact, the official discussant seemed to have neglected to check his passport expiration date, and his bureaucrats were no more helpful than our bureaucrats would have been. So I would like to begin, I think, with a disclaimer. As many of you know, I'm not an autism researcher. If anything, I'm probably identified as a developmental psychologist, although I was trained in social psychology, and most of my work has to do with research methodology. My name is Roger Bakeman, and I'm a professor emeritus at Georgia State. So in that capacity, let me welcome you to Atlanta. These are the days we have, you know, every day of the year, so this is just typical. I really enjoyed these. So this is actually, for me, a stretch. So I may have some questions, and hopefully they will elicit more from you as well. And certainly those of you who have much more clinical experience and judgment, mine being nil, and being noted primarily as a numbers person, but a person who's spent almost his entire life looking at correlational designs, not experimental designs. So in a way, the experimental designs today are both, for me, a delight and a bit of a stretch. Also, I will admit another enjoyable feature of all of these presentations was that there was no acrimony. They were completely without acrimony, but they were with acronyms. So this was, so I think now I'm beginning to master the acronymy of this area. Filled with TLAs. TLAs? Three-letter acronyms. And of course, a few four-letter acronyms as well. But one question I think I have is the following. I understand the two endpoints of the continuum, one being experimental rigor and one being clinical judgment. So the effort is, how do we in fact find somewhere in the middle, which is the way I see what smart design is up to? And of course, it's also a smart, indeed clever acronym. So the question I have is this. Is it really successful in having your cake and eating it too? Or is it potentially a compromise that can satisfy no one somewhere in the middle? So that was one question I might ask the presenters to try to address. Indeed, if we have, is an adaptive intervention, which I think I understand, simply a rigid protocol to how much can clinical judgment feed back into the adaptive interventions? I understand the fact that the smart design, smartly, can inform adaptive interventions, but I wonder about how these play out in practice in their rigidity. I also have another question based on the data. One thing I didn't hear much of in the presentations was individual difference data. Now, I think I understand why that could be so. In many ways, the groups picked were quite homogeneous, even though I know you, that's not the way you characterize them. But from another point of view, these were all children about the same age. They were all minimally verbal. They were all, and so in that sense, it was actually a fairly homogeneous group. But now the data you showed us for the smart designs, the research that was done, if I understand the data correctly, would lead me as a clinician to say, always begin with some sort of augmented communication. Because on average, and note when I say a word like on average, I've sort of gone away from the clinical end of the spectrum back to that rigid research end of the spectrum, which deals with group averages and not what works in individuals. So, but it looked to me like on average, almost always, in every case, the probabilities tilted towards augmented communication. Now, early on in the presentation, there was a promise of, well, we're going to investigate factors because sometimes some of them are costly, and we're going to make judgments based on that. What I didn't hear was cost-benefit analysis. I'm not upset by that, particularly. I'm not an economic psychologist, although I know there is an area of the world, and many people would want to know more about that. But my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, augmented communication devices these days are cheap. Not always in the research that you've done, and in the past, and I've spent much of my life dealing with very, very highly expensive specialized devices that now cost nothing and fit the palm of my hand. I mean, after all, I was hired by Dwayne Rumbaugh, and so I've been around augmented communication devices, at least in my colleagues' hands, all of my professional life. So my questions would be, why not always augmented communication? But then another question arises. Have we learned something about those for whom they don't work? That is, you've told us about group averages, but I haven't heard about the individual differences more. Is that a place we want to go? And one more question, I'll stop with there and then hear what other smart people in the audience have to say. Another question is, by and large, most of your designs you present, at least today, were timed. That is, we make a judgment after a certain amount of time, 12 weeks. And parenthetically, let me make another comment. What's really smart about smart designs, what really impresses me the most, is the re-randomization. That's the way they get out of the rigidness of the usual experimental randomized control trial. And that's what really is strikes me as the promise and the smartness of it. Which leads me to one more question. So this is an embedded question. Why wouldn't every researcher use a smart design? That is, why aren't the old designs now passé? The only cost I can see is an increase in numbers. But after that first step, after that first 12 weeks, that is essentially a randomized controlled trial. So the first piece of smart design is an RCT, right? And therefore, you need no more numbers to get to that point. You need more numbers to get to the second points after re-randomization. Again, I didn't hear too much discussion of power today, but that's okay. That's probably more for the future. So, first question. Why wouldn't everyone use smart designs, always? Number two, do you have plans to get away from the time rigidity? That is, can you figure out earlier on who are the non-responders? I understand not caring about characteristics of non-responders. Your task, you're not personality theorists. You're not trying to predict who's going to be the slow responders. You're actually better than that. You're going to find out by measurement and then base your re-randomization on it. Okay, so I think those are my questions, some of my thoughts, and let's hear from other people as well and answers from our very smart panelists.